Hello, I'm Sumit Bose, and this is the Net Hero Podcast. We've got the branding, we've got the hat, we've got the t-shirt. You can get some of those. Get in touch with us if you'd like to know it. But what it's about, what is it about? You know what it's about. Net Zero for Business. This podcast is about how businesses can help us transition to being better as a planet. Better business, better planet. We want to hear your views from scientists, from business people, from academics, from politicians, from you, the general public. So if you're interested in how we can try and cut our emissions, tune in, subscribe, join us. Now, on to this week's episode. What's the point of net zero? Now, we've been discussing on this podcast all the things we've been doing all the way. And one of the biggest points, which I think matters the most, is that as we transition to net zero, we're doing something good for the planet. We all agree that. We want to pollute it less, screw it up less, fine. But how do we do it so that it is a just transition? How do we make sure that we don't leave it for people who are poorer, people in different parts of the world, you know, people who are from different backgrounds, that they can partake in it? Now, I won't go into the whole kind of global picture, but in the UK, we have a lot of issues right now, which everyone knows about. We have a cost of living crisis, and we've got a lot of people for whom net zero, frankly, they don't give a damn about. They're just trying to pay the bills. But these are the people that we can't afford to leave behind. And that's what I'm going to discuss today in a conversation with the Energy Saving Trust. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Stu Horn, who's head of policy. Hello, Stu.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Before we get into what we're going to talk about and kind of net zero and where we can do the things that help all of society get there, can you explain to our viewers and listeners, what is the Energy Saving Trust? A lot of people have heard of it. They kind of don't know what it is. Is it a government body? Are you a charity? Give us a little bit of background.
So we're an independent, impartial organisation. We've been around for about 30 years, and we're dedicated to providing advice to householders, government, businesses, promoting energy efficiency, low carbon transport and sustainable energy use. So we do quite a lot of things. We do that across the UK. We particularly work in the devolved nations, so Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. And we're a mission driven organisation. So we are profit for purpose, as not for profit group. So when we make money, we recycle that into delivering more programmes. And that's to try and help meet our 2050 carbon net zero targets. So we provide a lot of advice on our website for people. We provide advice services. We deliver government programs across the UK. We also do a lot of research and insight. So we try and think about the difficult problems and think about how they can be addressed.
You were set up, I think it was 92, I think it started. I do remember when a long time ago, my early part of my BBC career, that it was sort of the new thing that came around as a sort of consumer body. Was it set up by the government of the day? Was it set by academics? Or is it a sort of body that came out of industry?
We've had to challenge ourselves and look at the sort of types of services that we deliver. And a really good example of this is where we're thinking about data and where data-driven services could be transformational. So we're just launching a new tool called HomeWise. This is a data-driven advice tool, and it's designed to be provided, we're providing this for businesses to help their own customers. So it will help them provide bespoke energy advice for those people and their property and their lifestyles. But that's a really good example of the way that we've looked at what we can do. We've looked at how we can provide it, and looking to do something different that hopefully will help shift the dial.
One last point before we start talking about the main thing is, because it's always important to know where people, you know, have their bang in their buck. You say you're not for profit, but you make money. Where does the money come from? How are you funded?
Yeah, from a whole range of sources. So we've got a breadth of different incomes. Some of that's directly funded from governments for the services that we provide for them. Some of that is money that we make on it. So we bid for bits of work. So whether that's research and insight or delivering a certain thing that we bid for competitively. Most of what we do, we have to bid for competitively. That's good news for people getting value for money. But it also means we have to work really hard to prove that we're the right people to do the job. But we're a mission driven organisation. So where we're making money, we're then recycling that back into trying to develop what we do a bit further, be more effective. And to be able to sort of raise the pace of the transition.
Thanks for that. I think that was important to get the background in. Let's go back a little bit. And I know you've been in policy a long time, but not necessarily energy, but I sure as damn remember 92 quite well. And I certainly remember the 90s where, frankly, what was energy saving? Not really a thing that anyone thought about. I certainly didn't think about it. We were powered mainly by coal. It was kind of, you know, get into a big car, travel the world, do that sort of stuff. Had you seen, you know, looking back on the history of the trust, that engagement took a while to get in? Because it's one of those things, isn't it? It's until, you know, I would think probably the last 5 years, people have really started talking about energy. Now, maybe 10 years, people have been thinking about it. But I wouldn't think that in the early 2000s, there was much call for this. So was it just a very hard slog to get the message out there to say, like, hey, we've got to save some energy?
So I think everybody's been on a journey, and certainly the recent energy crisis has focused people's minds. It just, you know, I've been in my role for 3 years, and just the suddenly landing in an area where a lot of the focus from the media and politically has been all of a sudden we need to save a lot of energy, as well as thinking about decarbonisation and energy security, has just been quite a phenomenal pivot. But the long view is that actually people have been thinking about energy efficiency for a huge long time. If you can go back a bit further than 92, back into the early 70s, and think, well, actually the oil price shock really shook things up and got people to focus. So there was a recognition that the type of advice and support that we provide was needed in the 90s. That's evolved and grown over time to the point where, you know, what we do in Scotland, where we still provide a lot of support for people. We provided support for 140,000 households in Scotland. That advice isn't what we would have provided in 1992 or at the end of the decade. This is really sophisticated now. So we provide postcode level, home by home level, data-driven advice, which is personalised to each and every home. So we synthesise all the data that we've got in the background. We use smart meter data where we've got it to help people identify exactly what's right for them and for their circumstances. That's very different from what we're doing 20
years
ago.
That's super high end. Yeah, absolutely. So just to clarify that, if I typed in my postcode, could you give me a kind of rundown of how efficient my house is based on that? And you could tell me the things I could do to, you know, you give me a checklist, do it, do insulation, do this, whatever. You can do it to that sort of level. Would you be able to know?
Yeah, to a degree, depending on the data as a background.
Right. But it'd be, so if I've got a smart meter, you'll be able to see what I'm using.
And you'd given us permission to look at your smart meter data. So there are always sort of checks and balances to go through with some of those things. But yeah, based on the fact that we will crunch through those data sets, and a lot of that's doing heavy lifting from EPC databases. So the data is only as good as what you've got access to. But it helps us get into a really rich conversation with people very quickly. If you go to the Home Energy Scotland website, that's essentially what you do. You start a journey which starts digitally, and you put in your postcode information, you tell us what you're willing to share with us, and we can give you a lot of information digitally. And then if you've got particularly complex needs, or if you've got a vulnerability, we carry on that journey by the phone. Or if you're going into one of the programs that Scottish Government provides funding for, then it also goes onto a phone conversation just to make sure that's all a good customer journey.
I mean, that's really good. I didn't realise you did that. I just thought, you know, you give advice, you know, stuff on the website or some data. You can actually go and say to someone, right, give me your details and we'll help you start to save energy.
Yeah, and that's really, really powerful. And because it's so personalised, you know, the behavioural scientists will say, you know, more personalised information is more actionable. And so that helps the efficacy of the advice that we provide. So that's great. Unfortunately, if you go on Home Energy Scotland, it only works with a Scottish postcode. So
there had to be a catch.
we provide a service in Wales, which is which we provide for the Welsh government, which is similar in terms of the type of advice it provides. We provide a service for the Mayor of London. So if you live in London, you can go on that site, put in your postcode, and get that kind of personalised level of advice. What we think is really missing is that there is an absence of that consistency of advice across the whole of England.
Yeah, it should be absolutely across the whole country, shouldn't it? Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you're working on that one, Stu.
We are, and that's one of, you know, well, I'm sure we'll come back to it later, but we think of some of the big gaps that are in government policy. You know, that
we'll cover that in a minute.
Rich, consistent advice, that's one of the biggies.
Before we go on to where we should be from now, I just want to go back a little bit again, just to give the listeners and viewers context. Efficiency, you said that, yes, the shock of the early 70s oil crisis, I think 73, I can't remember, whatever, but that changed things. For example, the Nordic countries invested in hydropower, whatever. And I suppose people started to see things like timers on devices. I remember in the 70s and 80s, because I'm quite old, you know, Economy 7 electric to do, you know, heating at night and things like that. But obviously, there were some basic things that people knew, but not the level of sophistication. Has efficiency really changed? So is it, there are probably two ways of looking at it. One, our housing and our buildings, not just offices and housing, but also then the products. So what would you have seen in terms of kind of how we've transitioned? Because I do remember, you know, insulation. I do remember people talking about kind of drilling walls in the kind of early 80s, but not much else. Certainly didn't think about products being more energy. Everything was hot. TV was hot. Everything was hot. So it was wasting lots of energy. How have we changed as a nation in those two areas? One, our kind of infrastructure, the bits and bobs we live in, the buildings we work in, and secondly, the products and things that we're buying now.
Oh, goodness. Well, I suppose the fabric, we have, in terms of building fabric, we have some of the poorest performing housing in the whole of Europe. And I mean, that's improved incrementally over time, but there's still a lot of heavy lifting to do in terms of improving building fabric to lower people's energy use. I think, you know, sometimes those are a little bit, it gives you two, in terms of policy, gives you two options. One of them is about decarbonisation. Mm. One of them is about lowering costs and decarbonising at the same time. There's a really interesting debate to get into there. But actually, a lot of the low hanging fruit is still there and needs to be tackled. So there's still lofts that need insulating. There's still walls that could be simply insulated. There's some tougher, deeper retrofit that can happen too. I think there's a, you know, that's where richness of advice can really help transform people's ability to think, well, what do I do? What's right for me? There's also some stunning statistics about the number of people who could be putting loft insulation in or wall insulation in who just haven't done it, but don't realize that they need to do it. So we're still, there's still some easy things that we need to do.
Yeah, it's amazing. Do you think it's because of the age of our housing stock? Also, a lot of people live in conservation areas. There's a certain thing about us, which is we're never going to do it until we really have to. Whereas in other nations, they're like, hey, let's build everything with timber and, you know, put wool in and we're happy with that. It doesn't matter what it looks like.
Well, it's a multifactorial issue. And I think people who work in energy efficiency will tell you there's no silver bullet. And there's lots of different things at play. So there are lots of behavioural characteristics, you know, hassle, cost barriers.
Yeah.
Just knowing where to start. I've actually gone through my own, I'm going through my own retrofit journey.
All right, yeah.
So I've had a retrofit assessment. It brought through things I wouldn't have thought about without having an expert on the premises. So, you know, there are some really complex bits of things that are going on, which we shouldn't expect people to be clued up on, because
of course,
you know, they're going to think about this maybe once or twice in a lifetime, whereas I think about this every day. It's very, very, very different. And then in terms of the products,
well, they are smarter, aren't they? They use less energy than they did 20 years ago.
Absolutely. And there's been some quite phenomenal advances with product policy, and some minimum standards really matter for whatever you're building. And, you know, there's still space to improve across the board there. And you think of something like a light bulb, and the other here I think is, you know, in the 90s we were telling people to turn lights off to save energy. You know, we're not in that world anymore. That's that's all banked and should be done. But actually, there's, you know, look at the government consulted last year on tougher standards for light bulbs, and that's more efficient LED light bulbs rather than just LED light bulbs overall. So there is still space for improvement in products, but then some products just themselves are transformational. So heat pumps use a third of the primary energy that old-fashioned heating systems use, and so you've got a massive energy saving in there. Electric vehicles use a third of the primary energy of internal combustion engine vehicles, so you've got these big steps forward in terms of just the amount of energy. And then also we're now entering into a world where it's about when you use energy, not about what it is. And things like batteries, and the ability to time shift energy and be flexible can be transformational, both in terms of the cost and the amount of carbon that are entailed. And I think that's a really exciting future. And that's, in terms of the ability to change things by having smarter products in people's homes. One of the things that we provide advice about is if you've got a smart thermostat, it's one of the biggest hitting simple things that you can do in your home in terms of saving energy. So some of these are actually really big wins.
I'm going to talk about policy in a second. The last point on this, you know, you can knock governments and you can actually knock energy companies, but they do offer schemes where you can get insulation for free. They do offer things like that. And I've spoken to loads of people in the industry. They just don't get the take up. People don't. Do you think there's a block that, you know, we as a nation just don't, and it's only this last 2 years when energy prices have gone bonkers that's really hit people in the pockets that they think about that, because they'll just think, well, yeah, whatever. I don't really need to do the loft. I can't be bothered to have that. I don't want to invest in changing all my bulbs, even though I know it's all out there. So all the technology is there. Most people, if I walked on the street right now outside this office, would know these things. But if I asked them how many have done it, probably not even 5 to 10% would have done it. Why do you think there's that reticence that you can't give away free insulation, as someone in the industry told me?
Well, I think some of it is about policy. It's about scheme design.
Right.
Getting those things right. And also giving consumers the confidence and the ability to the confidence and the, so it's just about awareness and it's about confidence, knowing that, okay, I can go with this. I can trust the thing that's being offered. And I know that if something doesn't go right, then I can get it sorted out.
But is there something culturally with us that we don't want to do? Whereas if you go to Scandinavia, kids are brought up, you know, I've been to friends in Holland, they're all brought up with sort of energy. I don't know if that's a big thing or it's just something that we've, you know, said in the press, but I do think there is a cultural difference.
So I haven't got any stats or evidence about culture difference, but we did do a big piece of work for the CCC last year looking at the countries who have really shifted the dial in terms of cutting cost and cutting carbon at the same time. And France has an exceptional energy efficiency. Well, actually, I'm going to wind back a bit. If you look across all of the European countries, almost all of them managed to make more progress on energy efficiency than we have. and France has a particularly impactful retrofit program. But I was talking to somebody whose parents are French, and he was saying to me, actually, I went through the process. It didn't feel very different to applying for energy efficiency grants in the UK. And I think some of that is about, well, actually, we know what needs to be done, but we need to package it up properly so that it's attractive for people, so that people then have confidence and they also follow it through. And we see much higher rates of energy efficiency installation in Scotland.
Yeah, because it's colder.
But it's also part of the UK. And so, you know, and you've got a government, you've got devolved housing policy in Scotland. So you've got a government there that's provided a bigger wraparound package, both in terms of the amount of funding that's on offer, but also the amount of advice and the surrounding sort of ecosystem that's helping people to take the next moves and get on with it. Yeah, it is a bit colder, but then, you know, I don't think, you know, it's also cold in the north of England. So, you know, if we're comparing apples to apples, you can see quite a big disparity in terms of the rates.
So you think that's policy. Let's get on to policy. Right, so 2019... Now, I don't really want to go before that, really. I mean, we can talk about all the previous generations of energy kind of policy, but we'd be here all day. Let's go to net zero. Let's talk about, you know, Chris Skidmore writing into law in 2019 the 2050 target that Theresa May set. You were definitely in this sort of space then. Looking at that, do you see that that was a pivotal moment? Because before that, there was the trilemma and, you know, sustainability. Do you think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but do you think an actual target has made a difference for businesses and the sector and policymakers?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the cheapest things that government can do is create certainty and long-term thinking.
Yeah.
And what the 2050 target does, it gives you a long-term signal that this is the direction of travel. This is where we're going to have policies and businesses and collaboration lining up to try and deliver something. And that feels a long way away, but it gives you time to think about how you're going to do it and how, you know, how it's all going to come together. Now there are big gaps in terms of that roadmap and delivery, but what it does is it coalesces thinking around it. And it really matters what that absolute target is, because previously, before the net zero,
just be sustainable is good.
There was an 80% target. Yeah. So you could, you know, you get into a point where you're thinking, well what's the difference between 80% and 100%? It does matter, because actually that last 20% is much harder. And you need to have good policies in place to do that heavy lifting for the last 20%. And you need to be able to, you need to be thinking about that now. So people like the CCC have to be doing the analysis to enable you to understand, well, how are we going to do it? What's the sequencing going to be? You know, where are the knotty problems going to be, where we need to sort of marshal our thinking and our policies to make sure that we're addressing them early enough to catch them and deal with them.
And we were recording this just before the budget, but you know, I don't think about unless there's a massive shift. But in general terms, over these last 5 years since we've had this target, as a policy expert, a lot of people would say, don't knock what we've done. We've actually pulled a lot of levers. We've shown a lot of leadership. And others would say, we've not kept up to our words, we're running behind, we're watering down. Where do you see us as a nation, the UK, in terms of how we've set that target in 2019 and how we're progressing in these past 5 years in terms of policy?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, Chris Stark has announced he's leaving the CCC, and I think, you know, he puts this very eloquently, which there are some parts of UK energy policy, if we just focus on energy policy, some parts of energy policy that are, you know, absolute success stories. Yeah. Offshore wind, phenomenal what we've done. But to compare that with onshore wind, you've got a big issue. You've got a big problem, because we haven't as progressed as much as, especially in England, as other countries have. And you look at where we are with energy efficiency and a target for deploying heat pumps, and we're behind where we think we ought to be in terms of picking up the curve. And a lot of that change in pace of delivery, according to the modelling we do, is at the end of the decade. So we need to, each year, we need to be incrementally picking up the pace and delivering more and more. We're not showing enough signs of doing that. And that's not because it's not possible. So again, if you look at France has dramatically picked up its pace of insulating and deploying heat pumps, a rate that, you know, we should all be jealous of. And we should be looking at places like France and Germany and thinking, well, how have they done this? And what is it that's shifted the dial in terms of deployment? So it's a mixed bag. And we've been leaders in terms of net zero on the global stage. We're a bit at risk of losing our place at that. You know, things like the Inflation Reduction Act, and which have been mirrored all across the world in terms of industrial policy, and those policies that will help us or other countries to decarbonize, are phenomenally ambitious and big thinking policy frameworks. We don't have our response to that yet. We haven't looked like we're putting one together, but there's one in Korea, there's one in Japan, there's one in China, you know, all over the world, people are thinking, well, how do we put these big policy frameworks in that are going to help us, you know, have the industrial base that's in place, but know that how we're going to, you know, improve energy security, you know, make sure that we're pushing energy costs down, make sure that we're decarbonizing at the same time. So, I mean, that's a big gap. And then also there are gaps in terms of the roadmap of how we get to some of the targets that we've got. So we've got a target of getting most homes to EPCC by 2035. We don't have a detailed roadmap of how we're going to get there. So, you know, that's just for me and what I do day to day.
Just stopping on that point, and everything you've said, it really makes sense, but I always struggle on this. Is it government's job to put down the roadmap and then also open up the funding? Because you look at what, you know, Biden's done. He's basically said this is the government tap is opened, right? And a lot of people say the only way we do this is we just go, it is state funded to set these things up, create subsidised markets that, you know, commercial companies then start to make. I think we've tried to take a sort of more 50-50 approach, which is, here's a kind of policy, hey, commercial companies, come in. Do you think that's been wrong? Do you think that the companies, they've got money, let's be honest, haven't, you know, pulled their weight? And sort of a lot of the blame has fallen on government, when maybe it could be a portion to, you know, the actual commercial entities who are, you know, there's flipping tons of money in this country.
And there's a lot of good companies as well. So I think, you know, I suppose the first thing, place to start, is that, is it government's job to just turn on tap of funding and deliver.
We all got to pay for it in the end, haven't we?
Absolutely. And there are, you know, there's a cost benefit to all of this. And actually, if you look at the amount of money that the government had to pay out to subsidize energy bills, you know, very recently, actually, you can see where the trade-off was quite immediately. Now, will we have another situation that looks quite like that? Probably not. But we are in a situation where volatile fossil fuel costs are driving energy prices. If there was another supply shock, then we could see prices go up again. Hopefully we don't. But actually, the prudent thing would be making sure we don't use as much energy in the first place. And that then becomes a national an issue around the, sort of the performance of the whole economy that the government should be thinking of. But there's so many different levers the government has to be able, and the UK government, sorry, in particular, to be able to shape that. So they don't have to turn on the funding tap, but they need to, for everyone, but they need to be able to facilitate the ability for everyone else to shape that market and deliver. So there's a huge amount of private money that can be motivated, but that requires shaping of the market. It requires certainty and long-term thinking. Otherwise, the market won't respond.
And it requires consistency, I assume. That's what they need. This is absolutely, it, and we're going to stick to that.
And if you don't have those things in place, it's very difficult for the market to respond. Now, the Inflation Reduction Act does turn on the tax of spending.
Yeah.
But what it also does is it turns on huge amounts of long-term certainty for subsidies and for a policy framework that the market can then respond for. So it is the government turning on the tax in some respects, but it's also then facilitating massive amounts of market delivery in other areas as well.
Where does the trust sit on where we are right now? Because obviously we've set targets, we've had a little row back on certain things, we've had the whole, complaints about, or is it prudent after what happened with the Ukraine scenario to look at oil and gas still that's there in the North Sea? Some people say, don't touch it with a barge pole. Have we done anywhere enough inefficiency? Where would you say, if you were going to give a scorecard on policy, whether we've flip-flopped a bit too much in the last 5 years, and some of that might be due to COVID and other things, whatever, but how would you see the performance of the government in terms of setting what you just said, that kind of roadmap where people who have got the money will go, right, we'll be in it for the long term?
Yeah, so I think we're at a point where the UK government recognises the problem. And actually, this is an area that I've worked in policy for quite a long time, and it's uncanny to have the level of consensus that we have around what action needs to be taken. But what we don't have is that clear roadmap about how that action can be put in place. And so that's the bit that's really missing.
And is that the government's duty to give us that roadmap?
It's a government's duty. And so I suppose where this gets complicated is that in a country like the UK, where you've got lots of devolution,
yeah,
you have the UK government holding the reins for some things, and devolved governments, whether that's in Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, or Metro Mayors, holding the reins for others. I'll give you a really good example where these things come together very sharply. So energy policy is a retained UK government issue. So when you're deciding how expensive heat pumps are to run and what policies help to make them cheaper, that's the UK government's job.
Gotcha.
But when you're rolling out heat pumps to low carbon heat in Scotland, actually the Scottish government is trying to get more heat pumps into homes, but it can't directly affect the price of energy. So you've got a real cut across incentives there. It makes the job of rolling out decarbonised heat in the devolved nations harder. You could say the same for Manchester or for Birmingham, for the Metro Mayors. All of them are having to go look at the UK government and say, we know that there are policies that you need to sort out.
Yeah.
Can you get on with it, please? But again, those are, the price of energy is one of those ones where, and the relative price of energy, so gas compared with electricity, is an area where the UK government's given warm words, but it's yet to actually take the actions that bring that cost down.
I started at the beginning saying that we want a just, and I think it's a very important thing, a just transition. So it's not just the middle classes who've got a nice drive and can have an EV and can afford solar panels. You get it, and someone's living in a crap hole in a tower block and they're freezing and they can't get a heat pump there. As the trust, what would you, if you could sort of really influence where we're going, what would you want to do to try and ensure we don't get that real gap between the haves and have-nots in a net zero future?
Yeah, so So first thing, there needs to be a retrofit plan. So if we just think about retrofit, there needs to be a retrofit plan for England. And that's got to be cognizant of where the winners and losers are in terms of, or potential winners and losers rather, are in terms of how quickly that action happens, and you know how you make sure that people don't miss out while that transition is happening. You can't retrofit everybody's home instantly.
No.
So there's a period of time where you know you know that some people are going to be in more costly homes than others. A really good example of this for people who are in rented homes is there's been much more progress in social housing.
Of course.
Than there has been in private rented housing. So actually, if you're in social housing, likelihood is the quality, your home is probably a higher level of fabric than if you're in a rented home. So that's a disparity in the rental market, which is really acute. Plus, there's less ability for people in rented homes to make those changes to their houses. So you know, those sorts of issues are really important. So in a retrofit plan, trying to make sure that there are the right incentives and also regulations that help help to make sure that the private rental sector is keeping up with other areas. So a national retrofit plan, really important. We held a round table just before the end of last year. We put sort of almost 20 retrofit experts in a room, thought about, well, how do you accelerate the deployment of retrofit? You know, what does good look like in terms of providing advice and information, you know, to raise awareness and then provide support for people, but then also how do you feed that into a retrofit plan? So we've got a bit of a briefing on kind of what works, but none of this is sort of super complicated. It's about having sort of coordinated, sort of detailed information and making sure that things join up, and that you've thought about all the different dimensions of the problem. So having that plan for England is really important. There needs to be a national advice service for England. So hand in hand with what you do, how you do it, supporting people so that they can access any grants and funding that's available from the national government or from local authorities, but also that people can then tap into all that private financing that's available. So you want to make sure that the key thing here is retrofit, decarbonised heat. There's a lot of upfront costs involved, but it doesn't have to be. So if you can access grants or zero interest loans or low cost financing, that tackles the upfront cost, allows you to pay it off along the way. That's what we've been doing on gas boilers. You know, there are lots of commercial companies that have that model for gas boilers for a long time. So this isn't a new thing. The way that you construct that finance in the background, yes, that's going to be different. But that principle that people don't face an upfront cost and then pay it off along the way, that's something that consumers are very used to. And then I think the third thing is that I think we want to see a really big acceleration on the deployment of heat pumps in homes.
Right.
There's a number of reasons for that. I mean, first and foremost, heat pumps are just really efficient. So they use much less energy than gas boilers or traditional electrical heating systems. We think the CCC say that they should be, you know, we should be installing at least 600,000 heat pumps by 2028. I think we're some way off that target at the moment.
Way off that, yeah.
And so there need to be the policies in place that help to facilitate that and help people to get those into their homes. So on the government scorecard, you know, there's some good things that have happened. So the boiler upgrade scheme, that's got a bump in terms of the grant that's available. That does two really important things. So one, it provides funding for people who are going to switch out from a boiler to a heat pump. But secondly, it gives the industry a really strong signal that the government's serious about rolling out heat pumps, and that allows them to invest in their workforce, in the skills that their staff have, allows people to retrain across from other industries, you know, or at least give businesses the signal that that's something they can do and get on with. That one mechanism really important, but it's not enough on its own. It needs to be a suite of other policies that help to lower the upfront costs of heat pumps, whether that's through grants or for low-cost loans, but also reduce the running costs in the long term. And there needs to be a suite of protections that make sure, consumer protections, that make sure that, you know, if you're doing 1 million anythings, nothing's a perfect market. So some things will go wrong along the way. So making sure that people can get advice, support, redress when those things happen, and that those are good markets for people to be involved in, is absolutely vital.
Before we go, one quick final point. I think most people would agree with what you've said, but we've seemed to have gone down, and I get why we've done it, we've gone down the building route, right? Build wind farms, you know, maybe build nuclear power stations, build anything that, you know, carbon capture, whatever. It's all about the generation. For us to get to net zero, how seriously do we all have to look at the bit of energy we don't use, the efficiency part? Because I just think that's still not the thing in our psyche. That you know, people still leave the lights on, people still set the temperature 23 when they could live at 20 or 21. What do you think it'll take for us to get efficiency up there where, you know, people like to see big things being built? People love all that idea. We're building new power stations, we're getting EVs, it looks great, but I've still got a leaky window and I've still got insulation that's not there. When are you going to see efficiency seen in the same light as these big things that we look at when it comes to kind of, you know, big energy infrastructure?
Well, I think we have seen a real focus on it over the last couple of years, and that's been driven by high energy prices. But also there's, you know, and I suppose in terms of the consumer appetite, we get colossal traffic to our website of people hungry for advice. And we reached over 12 million people with energy saving tips via our awareness campaigns last year. So, you know, the demand's definitely right. There.
Yeah.
What is more difficult is that every home is different. Every home is different. Even if you walk along a street and all the homes look similar, when you get inside, they're all different. So everybody's in their own personal situation. Everybody has slightly different needs. And so making sure that there's the right support for people to be able to respond from their own situation. And you know, it's a population that's, we live in a population that's not homogenous. So some people are much more able to respond to the sorts of signals and advice that you provide than others. And it's important to recognize what's going to be needed that's different for different people. So that's really important. In terms of our mission, we're continuing to think about ways in which we can deliver more advice to more people, in a more agile way. And principally, you're thinking about what kind of tools can we develop that will help to really improve access to personalised advice, which we know is highly effective to help people to make those decisions. But there's also a flip side, there is more focus that could be put on energy efficiency from government policy.
Yeah, sure.
So, it's easier if you think about what do ministers like to do? Ministers like to stand in front of things and
exactly, yeah.
So a new wind farm, a new battery plant, you know, all of these things
look great. Big solar panels behind them. Yeah, absolutely.
I'd love it if they stood in front of a street where every home had been retrofitted, or if there was a loop heat pump that had been rolled out. I mean, that'd be fantastic to see. I mean, because it's distributed, it's more difficult.
Yeah, I get it.
For that to happen,
but energy saving is sexy. Is that right?
It should be.
Exactly. Yeah. Do you know what, Stu? We've run out of time, but thank you very much. I'm on your website now, theenergysavingtrust.org.uk. So check that out. And it is great. I can see where you got the cut through the hot air on heat pumps. Very nice. I like that.
Yeah, that's our new heat pump campaign. So that's just going live. But yeah, you know, to try and do a bit of myth busting about what heat pumps are and what they do, and try and cut through some of the noise that's been in the media that's been helpful about.
No, it's great. It's great stuff here. There's loads of stuff here for business as well about demand flexibility. So I think if you're listening or watching, check out the website. Stu, thank you so much for your time. I think it's been really valuable, because one of these things we always look at is kind of where we're going, the big things, you know, the infrastructure, what business is doing. But saving energy, I think, is one of the things that we must do the most. So really appreciate your time coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me here.
No problems. What's your thoughts on energy saving? I hope you're doing it. Does your business need some help? Are you doing anything in your own home life that you think would be worth explaining a bit more? Get in touch on social media or drop us an email, nethero@futurenetzero.com. I'll catch you for the next episode.
You've been listening to the Net Hero podcast with Sumit Bose from Future Net Zero. Visit our platform for all things net zero. And if you or your business is doing great things on the path to net zero and want to be featured on the podcast, email nethero@futurenetzero.com. Follow us on social media. Futurenetzero.com. Better business, better planet.